Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to New York Metro Weather's first discussion. I guess you can say that it's the first time that we've done something interactive like this. My name is John Hominuk, and I am a forecaster in New York Metro Weather, and we are waiting to get Doug Simonian on here as well, and he's going to be calling in to speak with us, and we're going to essentially go over what we released earlier today, which was our winter forecast. That's something that we worked on for a long time. Obviously it's a process. It takes a couple months, and the plan in the next 40 minutes or so is to kind of just break it down for you. We want you to be able to understand exactly how we go about making this forecast. And you know, the interesting thing about seasonal forecasting like this is there's always going to be differing opinions among staff members. Every meteorologist has his own opinion on, you know, exactly what's going on. So we try our best to talk and make sure that everything is organized within our forecast and kind of come into some kind of agreement before we release anything at all. So, it took us a while to do that, and we were able to do it, and we're happy with the final result. And we want to take the time to discuss it with you today. So as soon as Doug calls in and gets in here, we will get that organized and start the discussion. One thing that we want to make sure you guys know is that you can call in at any time. The number to call is 347-989-8548. And that's the interactive number where we'll be notified that you are calling us. And we will discuss with you whatever question you might have in regards to our winter forecast. We'd love to speak with you and talk about it. So we're in a little bit of a holding pattern right now as we wait for Doug. And we're going to, I guess, get started with our winter forecast discussion just momentarily here. All right, so it looks like we have Doug on the air here. Let's see if I can... I can grab him. Let's see, Doug, is that you?
Yeah, do you hear me?
Yes, sir. All right, so we have Doug finally on the line here. And so what we're going to do with Doug, I was just explaining to everyone, just in the general sense of the plan here is just to go through the winter forecast process. I encourage anyone who's listening or this will be a podcast later tonight, and we'll be able to, you guys will be able to listen to this down the road, but I encourage you to pull up our winter forecast and kind of go through it with us, because that's kind of the whole point of what we're doing here, is to kind of discuss everything, have a 40-minute time to kind of go over all the data and all the thoughts that we had and kind of break it down into a little bit of a more simplistic fashion to make it a little bit easier to understand for those of you that, have a hard time looking through everything like that and, understanding, and we understand it can get kind of droning at times. So what we want to do is just start from the beginning and go over the basics of the thoughts we developed and how we came about this forecast. So obviously the biggest piece and this has been the big shebang right now in the meteorological community is the El Nino. So Doug, in the forecast, when obviously we were sitting down and talking about it, it was such a major thing. In a simple form, how would you best describe the El Nino? I was trying to think of ways to do it, but I figured I'd leave this one up to you. Obviously, it's a strong El Nino, and it's the strongest in quite some time. But in terms of factoring it into the forecast, how would you describe, how we went about doing that?
Well, in previous years, last year and the year before, we didn't really have a strong El Nino signal. So, because it was a pretty weak El Nino, so while we factored it in, we didn't factor it in nearly as much as we usually would because it wasn't that strong. Now that the El Nino is so strong this year, it becomes a much more significant weight into the overall aspect of the forecast. So the El Nino is really the primary tool that we were using to predict the winter, whereas other years, other tools would get a little more weight. As far as the strength of the El Nino is concerned, it's up there with some of the strongest El Ninos on record. It really might approach the strongest El Nino on record. It's a basin-wide El Nino, meaning The entire El Nino regions are all pretty warm. It's not all the warmth is relegated to one spot. It's pretty spread out across the entire equatorial Pacific, whereas
right.
some of the other strongest El Ninos on record, most of the warmth has been pushed eastward right off the coast of Peru, which leads to a few differences here and there as far as how the El Nino will behave down the road.
Correct. And I think, that very well said. One of the interesting things, this is the ongoing debate now, is, we know this El Nino is one of the strongest on record. In fact, today, the 3.4 data passed the 1997 pace. So, I think that's something to keep in mind, too. It's still strengthening. Now, a lot obviously has to do with the location of where the warmest anomalies are and where the tropical forcing is over the next month or two. And we have seen in the last couple of months the eastern areas of the El Nino fluctuating a little bit in terms of temperature. Now that obviously has a major impact on the pattern going forward. And I think one of the things we spoke about too in our forecast was how important it is to kind of monitor what goes on in the next month or two. When we looked at the past El Ninos that were this strength, or I think we looked at the top five strongest in the last within the period of history that we had available, the top five strongest El Ninos, all of them had what seemed to be a double peak in terms of intensity. And the ones that were, very warm and featured very little snow during the winter months, those peaks were in the middle of winter. And so I think that's something that we have to really be watching over the next couple of months. And that makes this winter forecast unique to the other ones in the last couple of years. It's almost a waiting game a little bit in terms of the El Nino and how it behaves. And so moving from there, I think the next thing that was very, very important to discuss, and I touched on this a moment ago, is the tropical convection and the tropical forcing. Doug, you had a lot of information about this in terms of the differences between the east base, the basin-wide, and the way that it behaves in terms of how it affects the weather. Moving forward, what do you think, how is it best said in terms of what we're looking for this winter and over the next couple of months in terms of the behavior of the El Nino and the forcing as well?
All right. Well, first of all, I want to thank the username OHWeather on the American Weather Forums for providing some great visuals on how these different El Nino events behave. But getting to your question, the tropical forcing, it's kind of a complicated concept, but, there's one thing to have warm water in a certain spot. El Nino is known for having plenty of warm water in the equatorial Pacific, but the atmosphere needs to respond to that warm water, or the warm water doesn't matter. And that's where we look at tropical forcing. This tropical forcing is what actually leads the atmosphere to respond to the El Nino, and thus the different weather patterns that El Nino brings to the United States. To summarize what tropical forcing actually is, warm water or warm anything tends to rise more. So if you have an El Nino, there's going to be a lot more lift in the equatorial Pacific because there's more warm water, and more warm water will rise more. So where we see most of that rising motion is where the most of the tropical forcing is. And all that rising air in the tropics can lead to very different weather patterns across the northern Pacific and thus eastward across the United States. During some of the strongest El Ninos on record, since a lot of the warmest waters were further east towards the coast of South America, the tropical forcing was also further east, which led a lot of important pattern features, the strong Gulf of Alaska low pressure system, to also be located further east. Now, if you scroll further down to our winter forecast, you see these composites for east-based El Ninos and basin-wide El Ninos. There is this dark purple cold anomaly for east-based El Ninos along the Gulf Coast, along the coast of Alaska. When you see that there, that blocks almost all of the cold air from the Arctic and makes our winters very warm. But during the basin-wide El Ninos, that low pressure system shifts further west, and gives more room for Arctic air to plunge southward.
Right. And I think that speaks to what, you know, when you and I were discussing this winter forecast, it's very much walking a fine line. And when you look at it, and, you know, as we started to look at this, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, but as we started to look at it, the more we researched, the more we realized how just a slight difference in conditions in the tropical Pacific can have a huge impact on our weather. The east-based forcing has a huge impact on the pattern when you look at the analogs. And a lot of that has to do with that trough in the Gulf of Alaska and where it's positioned.
Right. I mean, in the 1997-1998 winter, the whole winter for the most part was so warm because that Gulf of Alaska low just was massive and sat right along the coast. And when it sits right along the coast, it brings Pacific air into the entire country, which in Pacific air is really not that cold. It's very rarely going to support snow. So pretty much for the whole winter, we were not cold enough for snow. But if you shift that low pressure just a little bit further west, like in the more basin-wide El Niños, you're giving room for a ridge to form out ahead of that low in northwest Canada. And when a ridge forms in northwest Canada, the cold air can slide right down the ridge into the United States. And that's why you see a much colder and troughier composite for the basin-wide El Niños than for the east-based El Niños.
Right. And you know, that to speak a little bit more about that Gulf of Alaska low in a very simplistic form, I'm sorry to back up for a second, Doug, but if anyone's listening along and wondering what that means, you know, when you have an area of troughing or lower heights in the Gulf of Alaska, you have to imagine the wave pattern further east. You know, typically a big low in the Gulf of Alaska, as Doug said, it floods us with Pacific air. It does not allow for a cross-polar flow or any cold air to sustain itself from Canada or the poles, and it pretty much cuts off the wintry pattern in our area. Now that shows up very strongly on the composite for an east-based forcing with El Niño event. When you look at basin-wide events, the whole evolution changes, and that Gulf of Alaska low is retrogrades much further west towards the Aleutian Islands. So instead of being just off the Pacific Northwest coast of the United States, the analogs, the anomalies are much further to the north and west. And having that trough over the Aleutian Islands opens up the opportunity for a ridge to go up on the west coast of the United States. And obviously, if you can imagine a wave pattern in your head, that is way more supportive of cold air and snow into the eastern United States. And not surprisingly, on those basin-wide events, historically, the composite is much different across the east coast, with much more propensity for there to be cold air and a lot more opportunities for snow. Moving forward, I think the other question in regards to the El Niño obviously becomes, how long does it strengthen for? You know, the ensembles are pretty large spread. I mean, when you look at the mid-October plumes, by November and December, there's a spread anywhere from close to 3 to down near 1.5. And I mean, that's pretty tremendous. So it's going to be interesting to see where the El Niño peaks. And I think obviously many people, I know that we're not alone in our forecast. Many people are hedging their bets in terms of their winter forecast. A lot of their forecast has to do with, you know, taking a gamble on how exactly the El Niño is going to perform over the next couple of months.
Right. I mean, that's very important, because I think the stronger the El Niño is, the more likely you are to have more east-based forcing as opposed to central basin-wide forcing. And accordingly, since El Niño is really still strengthening right now, the short-term projections for the tropical forcing actually match up more with the east-based composites than the basin-wide composites. So if that were to hold true for the whole winter, we'd be having one of the warmest winters on record with very little snowfall. But that being said, generally El Niños that have the configuration that ours has do progress towards the basin-wide forcing. And most models do forecast the forcing to shift towards the basin-wide composite towards the end of the winter, which is why we think the winter will start off warm and then gradually, to average anyway, get colder, especially in February.
Correct. And I think that's the debate moving forward. Is exactly how does the forcing set up, and when exactly does the El Nino begin to evolve and weaken or change in terms of its evolution? And that's obviously, as we discussed in our forecast, going to have such a tremendous impact on how the winter evolves, especially in our area of the country. So moving forward, we'll jump ahead a little bit here and discuss, obviously, you know, one of the better terms I've seen thrown around the community in the last couple of months has been the fact that the El Nino is a pattern driver. That the El Nino has such a huge impact on the atmospheric circulations around the globe. But there are plenty of other things at play too. And our winter forecast does the best to touch on a lot of them. One of them that we talked about, and Doug, I'll let you jump in here as well. I'll just, you know, touch on them a little bit, and then you can jump right in after with your thoughts. Obviously, the PDO is something that we look at. That's a measure of the sea surface temperature anomalies in the Pacific. And as we discussed in our forecast, over the last two winters, there really has been an area of very warm water in the Northeast Pacific, kind of hugging the West Coast of the United States, pretty much from the coast of Alaska along the West Coast and towards the southwestern United States. And then there's been cooler anomalies extending from the central Gulf of Alaska westward. This is a textbook positive PDO, and it's apparent again this fall to start, you know, as we move towards winter. At a very basic level, when you have, you know, warmer sea surface temperatures, you have more lift and you expand the vertical column of air, which in time causes more ridging. And I'll let you discuss. I know you, Doug, you and I spoke about this, or, you know, talked about it at length earlier, but that there has been a tendency for the ridging to go up on the West Coast. And, you know, the general idea is that the positive PDO has had some impact on that. So, Doug, I guess, you know, your thoughts on that, and moving forward into this winter, knowing we have a positive PDO, you know, I guess just kind of explain how we tied this into the forecast and how we weighted it.
Right. Well, generally, El Nino do have a positive PDO, so this isn't really a surprise that we have this feature. That being said, usually in the strongest El Nino events, the PDO is not nearly as positive as it is right now. And a lot of that, as you said, is because of the fact that the warm pool in the Northeast Pacific has been so warm and has stubbornly stayed there. I mean, granted, it's not as strong as it was last winter, but it's still pretty strong. And the fact that it remained there, despite the fact that strong El Niños usually weaken that warm pool somewhat, I think says a lot about the overall state of the atmosphere. Because, you know, generally, you know, more warm water force a ridge to develop in along the West Coast, but it can at least help to sustain one. So this could mean, compared to other strong El Niños, that we have more ridging in Northwest Canada and along the West Coast than we usually would, which leads to a trough in the east, especially in the latter half of the winter. So while there definitely will be periods of very mild weather this winter, can't stress that enough, the second half of the winter could be a different story.
Yeah, I agree, and I think, you know, one interesting tidbit that we had in our forecast was the historical composites and analogs that we use and weight in our forecast. When there are multiple years with a positive PDO and values over one for that time period, which obviously we qualify for now, with the PDO has been positive since September 2014, I think. Those composites very significantly show the Gulf of Alaska trough being further west. So it's positioned south of the Aleutian Islands, and then you have ridging from the west coast of the United States into western Canada. And we discussed that earlier. You know, that's a pattern that does have a tendency to bring colder air into our area and give us the potential for snow. So, and that matches the negative East Pacific oscillation as well, with the ridging going into British Columbia. And so these are things that, you know, we have to wait moving forward. And I think watching this develop in the next couple of weeks is going to be very, very important. And that kind of, you know, leads us, it's a nice segue into the East Pacific Oscillation, the EPO. I'll let you kick this one off, Doug. In terms of the EPO, you know, how do you weight it, and how do you think it compares in terms of the other factors we've spoken about now so far in terms of the winter coming up?
Well, the EPO, I would say the EPO, atypical oscillation, might be the most important oscillation outside of El Nino on our weather. Because when you have a very positive EPO, you have a trough near Alaska, and that completely cuts off the cold air source. In order to really have true Arctic air plunging into our region, you pretty much have to have EPO being negative. As far as how much we weighted it, you know, it kind of went back and forth because generally, you know, strong El Ninos do not have the persistent negative EPO, but last winter we had one of the most negative EPOs on record, which is why we had so much cold air to begin with. I don't think we're going to have anything like that, but the fact that the PDO has been more positive than it usually would be, we seem to indicate that there will be more periods of negative EPO than one would normally expect in a strong El Nino. So we did weight it. You know, it had some pretty significant weight, not as much of a significant weight as the El Nino itself. But I think considering the strength of the El Nino, the other factors are not nearly as important, but the EPO is still up there, maybe the second most important factor that we looked at for this winter.
Right. And I think, you know, one thing that we talked about in the winter forecast that, you know, I can't harp on enough in terms of my general mentality moving forward is the pendulum swing between control, a little bit of a fight for control between the El Nino and the PDO and the EPO and how they you know, dominate the pattern. And watching that unfold in terms of, you know, the modalities of all of them and seeing how each of them behave is going to be really, really interesting. And you know, I don't think that I've gone into a winter forecast with the idea that we're going to be seeing a little bit of a tug of war between the El Nino and the surrounding indices and seeing how they behave. So I think that's going to be really, really interesting to watch unfold.
Right, especially so considering especially considering the El Nino is so strong, you wouldn't think there could be a tug of war with something that strong. But with that warm pool in the Northeast Pacific, well, yeah, that doesn't necessarily drive the pattern. It's an indicator that there might still be residual forcings from last winter that made the EPO so negative to begin with. So I would not be surprised to see some strongly negative EPO periods, not like last winter, but, you know, there could be a couple of Arctic blasts of air in the second half of the winter. So definitely will be interesting to watch that unfold.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think, you know, that kind of slides us into the next pendulum and the next part of the pendulum, which is the Arctic Oscillation or the AO. Now, obviously, the state of the AO has been a major, major talking point in the community and, you know, hobbyists and even people that just read our forecasts. And the forecast is pretty uncertain this year and not similar to last year, really. Obviously, the negative phase of the AO features an atmospheric pattern that is conducive to cold air here and the general idea is that it's a snowier pattern when the AO is more negative. And so some interesting data came through this summer, and we did weight this in our forecast, obviously, but July of 2015 actually featured the second most negative AO on record for the month of July. And that was second only to 2009, and that number for 2009 was negative 1.3 in July. This year is negative 1.1. And then there are several years that were close to that, 1962, 1968, 1950. But the interesting thing moving forward was that out of the 15 most negative July Arctic Oscillation readings, 14 of them featured a negative Arctic Oscillation on average for the following winter. And so that is a pretty astounding statistic moving forward. And while it's not perfect, It's pretty remarkable to see that when you have an Arctic oscillation of that's strongly negative in July, the correlation is pretty strong moving forward. The other thing that has that lately has been a major driver in terms of understanding the Arctic oscillation or, you know, trying to understand it from the summer and fall moving forward is the Eurasian Siberian snow cover. So Doug, I guess discuss a little bit how this was weighted into the forecast. And I know, you and I went back and forth a little bit about this, but, in terms of the Arctic oscillation. You know, what are you thinking for the winter moving forward, and how does the snow cover, in your mind, affect our forecast for that?
Yeah, to be honest, I am not the biggest fan of the Siberian Eurasian snow cover method to predict the Arctic oscillation. I do think there's some lacking the snow cover, just because when you have more snow cover earlier in the fall, it tends to support more cold air masses being built, which could lead to stronger cold air masses down the road. So there's definitely an importance there, but I'm still a little bit of a skeptic as to how much the Siberian snow cover itself leads to an Arctic oscillation. Of course, one of the best scientists in our field, Judah Cohen, would disagree with me. You know, he came up with this Eurasian snow cover theory, where if you have a rapid growth of Eurasian snow cover in October, that could precede a negative Arctic oscillation winter, which was one of the big reasons why last winter was expected to have such a strong negative Arctic oscillation. Of course,
right.
That could not have been further from the truth.
Correct.
Which leads me to be somewhat skeptical of its future use. I'm not going to toss it. I think it should have some weight because his research was peer-reviewed. So that means there definitely is some credence to it. But pattern drivers, in addition to the snow cover, that are just as important, if not more important, for predicting the Arctic oscillation.
Correct. And I think, you know, weighting it is important. And that, you know, the tale goes, last year was the, I think it was the highest snow, in terms of that index, it was the highest snow cover, right, going into the winter?
Right. I think it was the highest ever.
Yeah, and obviously the Arctic oscillation did not respond. Everyone was expecting, you know, we had the highest snow cover in Eurasia or Siberia moving into the winter period. And we also had a weak El Nino last year, which tends to support a snowier and colder pattern here. And obviously it was cold and snowy, but the Arctic oscillation did not respond as that method would suggest that it would. So
right,
we're not going to go.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, we have all the cold and snow was pretty much from the negative EPO. The EPO was so negative that it didn't really matter what the Arctic oscillation and the NAO were doing. It was going to be cold regardless. But this winter, considering the EPO might not be as negative, it might be more important to have a negative Arctic oscillation to have cold this winter, which is why we are not nearly as confident in obtaining that cold as we were last winter.
Correct. And I think that's a theme to really harp on moving forward for anyone listening, looking for general ideas in terms of the winter. One thing we can say we're very confident in is that this winter will not be as cold as last winter at all. And that's, you know, almost without a doubt at this point. So moving forward, obviously the next big index, everyone's heard of this one, is the NAO. We weighted this in our forecast as well, as everyone does. And it's one of the more well-known indexes for predicting colder and snowier patterns in the Northeast United States. You know, most notably, I would say, its negative phase generally supports the development of high-latitude blocking. So when the NAO is in a negative state, you have higher heights in the Northwest Atlantic, Greenland, Central Canada, and obviously well-documented within the community. When you have high-latitude blocking, you tend to displace cold air further south, and the pattern is more supportive for snowstorms and precipitation in our area. Doug, in terms of the NAO this winter, and I know we haven't gotten a number yet on the October sea level pressure in the North Pacific, and I'll touch on that in a second, but, you know, I think we agreed on this pretty much going into the forecast, so what's your general idea in terms of the NAO this year, and, you know, how do you see it evolving over the next couple of months?
Well, yeah, as we discussed in the winter forecast, Al Marino did some extensive research, and I think he actually did post some final result on Twitter. I don't know if he posted the exact number or just a composite that would imply a final number, but based on his analysis,
I did the composite from October 27th. I think I posted that in there. Before you go, what we have so far for this year is a composite that will favor a negative NAO, but Doug, I guess explain exactly, you know, what we're talking about.
Okay, well, yeah, it's an interesting method to predict the NAO. I mean, NAO is one of the hardest indices to predict seasonally, but there seems to be a correlation between the North Pacific sea level pressures in El Nino winters,
right.
and the NAO state during the following winter. And
right.
it makes sense because in the North Pacific, the El Nino can strongly correlate to either, you know, Gulf of Alaska low, and depending on its exact position, has a major impact on the pattern in Canada and in the U.S. So the North Pacific plays a major role in many patterns, especially during El Nino, which is why he specifically focused on El Ninos. So if we have lower sea level pressures in the North Pacific in October, that tends to lead to stronger negative NAOs in the winter, whereas if we have more positive or higher pressures in that same region, it tends to lead to positive NAOs.
Correct. And I think, you know, in terms of that indication, it seems to be, as you said, during the El Nino winter. So the threshold, and for those that are wondering, when we're looking at the sea level pressure, threshold is right around 1,013 millibars. So, and it's interesting that it seems to be such a stout correlation, but when it averages below that, so for example, 2009 in the North Pacific, the October average sea level pressure was 1,011. When it averages below that, it almost always seems that the average North Atlantic oscillation during the months of December, January, February, and March is negative. And when the October sea level pressure in the North Pacific is higher than 1,013, so when it gets towards 1,015 and 1,014, the NAO almost always averages positive during the winter months. And so what we have this year is you know, and this only goes up to October 27th in terms of the data that I have in front of me, but it seems almost impossible that the sea level pressure would average higher than 1,013. At this point. So it seems very likely that this will fall into the negative NAO indicator. But obviously this is, you know, this is another one that's not perfect. It seems to be having a little better of a time, a little better experience than the Siberian snow cover the last couple of years.
Right.
But this is just one thing that we keep in mind moving forward. But to stick on the general idea of high latitude blocking, the general forecast that we came up with moving forward is that the stratospheric vortex is going to remain pretty stout for the first half of the winter. And that's obviously way, way up there in the atmosphere, the stratosphere. So that tends to promote a lack of high latitude blocking. So a positive NAO is, you know, I guess a very basic way to look at it. The general idea is that as the winter goes on, we'll see a pattern change beginning in the stratosphere where this will begin to erode. And we'll start to see an atmospheric pattern that is more supportive of high latitude blocking and of periods of a negative NAO moving forward. When you combine that with the idea that we have, you know, the conclusions we've come to in regards to the retrograding low in the Gulf of Alaska, you know, our forecast in February does include a tendency for colder air to intrude our area. And obviously with the precipitation continuing to be rather high from the El Nino, and the potential for high latitude blocking, the idea that the potential for cold and snow would come into the forecast by the month of February. I think that's something that we both agree on, Doug.
Right, yeah. I mean, one thing I found interesting about the El Merino research, to further back your point, is the three strongest El Niños on record, you know, the 1997, 1998, 1982, 1983, and 1972-73 El Nino, all were pretty strongly positive or strongly high in the October number for the North Pacific pressure.
Yep.
So this, I mean, not that this El Nino is that different from those, but it does kind of prove a point that this El Nino is not exactly like those super El Ninos that gave us so much warmth. While this El Nino is very strong, there are some differences between this El Nino in those years, including the El Merino SLP number. So
correct.
I found that pretty interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the general theme. You know, that's kind of, you know, as forecasters, one of the important things that we go through when we do seasonal forecasts like this is we, you know, we compile all the data and we look at everything individually, but the next step obviously is to figure out exactly how to weight it in a forecast, and then we have to come up with an overview of you know how we think things are going to play out. And that, you know, this year, and I said this a couple times in our winter forecast, it's kind of uncharted territory in terms of, you know, we don't really have anything to look back on in the past where the atmosphere has necessarily behaved like this. There's a lot of conflicting signals, and there's a lot arguing for the fact that there's going to be some pendulum swings in terms of what, you know, atmosphere drivers and responders are really holding the keys to the pattern. And I think, you know, it's going to be really, really interesting to watch it play out throughout the winter. And, you know, I wonder about the people who are putting out forecasts for, you know, wall-to-wall warm winters and who are going for warm and snowless, because, you know, for me, and I know for you and for Miguel and everyone who worked on our winter forecast, forecasting team, it seems really clear that there's a lot more at play here than just strong El Nino.
Right. I would agree with that.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, the general takeaway of our winter forecast in terms of that. The only, you know, the other, there's a lot of factors. I mean, I think, you know, and the El Nino itself, obviously we haven't seen one like this in quite some time. And so it's going to be interesting to see how it behaves exactly, and how the other, you know, the different forcings and different circulations around the globe are going to have impacts on the pattern. So we have a couple minutes left here, and I guess the last thing we could touch on, Doug, is the uncertainties moving forward, just in general. You know, what would you consider, and I'll give you mine afterwards, but what would you consider your biggest uncertainty moving forward into the winter?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I would say that although, you know, there is obviously a very low sample size for El Ninos of this strength, and especially of this El Ninos of this strength that are basin-wide, we still do have a pretty generally good understanding of how El Ninos behave and how they progress from December through January and February. But I think the biggest uncertainty really is the Arctic Oscillation and North Atlantic Oscillation towards the second half of the winter, because it's going to be crucial for those to be negative in order to maintain cold air masses, because we're not going to have that super negative EPO that we had last winter. It's just not going to happen. So without having that consistently so negative, we're going to be relying more on the Arctic Oscillation and North Atlantic Oscillation. And while we do have some good tools to use to predict those, those are still two of the hardest oscillations to predict over a 2-3 month time scale. So while we, you know, I'm very happy with the content we put out and our research, but that doesn't mean I'm extremely confident in North Atlantic Oscillation and Arctic Oscillation.
Yeah, I would have to agree. For me, moving forward into the winter, obviously, one thing, and I spoke to so many colleagues about this, is when you think back to last year, and I mean, obviously, it's a natural thing to do. You think back to last year, the differences in our forecast and, you know, the confidence moving forward are pretty startling. And I think there's a lot more uncertainty this year, and it's natural because of how the atmosphere is behaving. You know, and,
right.
And exactly how things play out are, you know, so dependent on exactly how these huge drivers of the pattern, like the El Nino and the PDO, and you know, whether we get blocking or not moving forward, exactly how they play out is going to have such a huge impact on our forecast. But that being said, I am confident that the second half of the winter is going to feature a changing pattern. You know, obviously we just put out our November outlook to the premium subscribers, and that is obviously a very warm outlook. But I think, you know, this winter is going to be something where the second half of the winter is obviously going to make or break the forecast.
Right.
And, you know, I think we took a long time to discuss that and get everything figured out. So I'm confident in it, but I'm very interested to see exactly how the atmosphere behaves. And it's going to be an exciting winter for sure.
Yeah, I'm excited.
So in terms of,
I mean, one thing that will definitely make this winter pretty exciting is with the strong El Nino, we get the strong subtropical jet stream, and there should be a lot of precipitation. There'd be a lot of rainstorms, but there, I think there will be a lot of storms to track. That's something that I think we're pretty confident in, right?
And you know, it's been, I guess what they call a meteorologist's dream over the last 6 months or so, because it's, you know, in terms there's been nothing. It's been so quiet. You know, we've had a lot of time to think and focus on this. It's almost like we know what's coming. So it's a ticking clock now in terms of when the pattern becomes active. And that's what we are going to discuss. And for those of you listening, or if you're listening tonight, or if you're listening in the next couple of days, we're very excited to let you know that we're going to be doing these podcasts at least once a week moving forward. The feedback has been really great on the podcast, even while we're on air here. And so we're really excited to bring them to you during this winter coming up. And so next week we're going to touch a little bit more on, you know, how we expect the pattern to evolve, and, you know, what's driving our potential pattern change, things like that. And, also just to touch on the local weather during the week and the week coming up and things like that. You know, Doug and I will be here, and we'd love to have you guys call in as well, to ask any questions you might have, also. So just to wrap it up, and Doug, I wanted to get your, ideas on this too, just to, give a little bit of a highlight. The conclusions that we came up with at our winter forecast, that December will be an above normal month in terms of temperature. January will be fluctuating, still averaging slightly above normal. And then February will end up with temperatures averaging below normal, with New York City snowfall ending slightly above normal. That was the general consensus that we came to. Just, I guess, talk a little bit about that and how we expect the winter to play out in a very basic form.
I mean, you know, last winter, you know, it got off to a slow start, too. Remember, December was, I think, about 3 degrees above normal in New York City. I think this December could be just as warm as last December was. So another slow start to the winter. I would say January is the month we're most uncertain about. You know, it depends on how and when exactly the pattern does change, and when does the Gulf of Alaska lower retrograde? Does it retrograde west in the beginning of January, the end of January? You know, right. Obviously, the earlier the pattern changes, the colder the month will be, and the later the pattern changes, the warmer the month will be. So the exact timing there makes January very uncertain. But there is a pretty strong consensus that in El Nino winters, the pattern evolves to a more snowier picture by February, thus a pretty high confidence in February. And the reason why we went slightly above normal snow is, although we do think in the means, December through February, maybe even March, in the means will be a little bit above average in temperature, there's going to be so much activity with plenty of precipitation and plenty of storms that it's only a matter of time before we time some of these storms with cold air intruding the northeast. So while there could be a lot of rainstorms, there could also be a lot of snowstorms. And with the enhanced moisture that El Niños provide, there is the heightened threat of a bigger snowstorm sometime in February or
and
March.
I think that has a lot to do with our forecast, you know, the second half of the winter. Being colder and trending that way towards the end of the winter after a warm start. So we have to wrap this up, unfortunately. But one thing that we wanted to say is thank you for everyone who was able to chime in. It's the first time that we did this. We're looking forward to doing it more. We're going to be back either the end of this week or next week. Stay tuned to our social media for updates. And thank you all who listened and participated. Doug, it's been a pleasure. And
indeed. I really had fun talking to you.
We'll be back with you guys next week. Take it easy, guys.